Hey there, it's Ziva, and welcome to On Becoming, a podcast that sheds light on the untold transformation stories of women leaders, creators, and entrepreneurs. Those decisive but often overlooked moments that shaped who they are and point us towards who they're becoming. Listen to find out how their hidden journeys can help unlock your own potential. Today I'm speaking with one of my closest friends, Adri Aki. Adri and I met in Paris through our mutual friend, Jessica Menendez. At the time, she was a graduate student passing through Paris while writing her decorative arts dissertation. She was living with friends, trying to make ends meet on a shoestring budget. She really wanted to stay in Paris, but she had to go back home because her visa was up. But back in New York City, on one of the photo shoots she was producing, she met and fell in love with a Swiss guy named Thomas, who happened to be based in Paris. Fast forward a couple of years into their relationship, and Adri is back in Paris, taking a second stab at the life she always fantasized about. As I like to joke with her, Adri V2 is a radically different woman. After having her first child, Numi, she launched a lifestyle publication for moms called Mana, which was short-lived, but super cool and modern. And then in 2018, she put all of her passions and talents under one roof when she created Madame de la Maison. A lifestyle brand, Madame de la Maison features items to make your gatherings memorable and beautiful, from linens and antiques to candles and caftans. And most recently, Adri's unique story, tips, and philosophy about how to bring more joy and beauty into your everyday life has led to a brand new book. Launched in April, Joie, a Parisian's Guide to Celebrating the Good Life, is already an instant bestseller. In this conversation, we talk about how she's pivoted many times professionally in her life, how feeling excluded and misunderstood became her North Star for seeking out places where she felt she belonged. What about Paris in particular has provided her with that space to fully bloom? What it means to her to be a Black woman representing rest, joy, and celebration in everyday life, and how embracing imperfection can be a radical act in the pursuit of connection to yourself and to others. I really hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I enjoyed making it, and I look forward to your feedback. Have a great listen. So, hello, Adri.
Hello.
Thank you so much for joining me here today on Becoming. So full disclosure to everyone listening, this is a redo of the conversation that Adri and I had back in April before her new book was launched. And we now have an opportunity to go back and add some information about what it's been like since her book launched. And it was all due to some technical brouhaha. So this is an opportunity to fill in some of the spaces and the gaps and add some more information with hindsight being 2020 about what has emerged since her book was launched. So thank you again for joining me. It's going to be very fun, as we had the first time, and even more fun, I'm sure, this time, going back and asking you some questions that we don't typically explore together when we're hanging out, even though our conversations do have a tendency to go very deep very quickly. So welcome to the show. How are you feeling this morning?
Good. Feeling great. It's super sunny in Paris for like the last week solid. So I love it. I'm feeling great.
Okay, wonderful. So you know what the concept of this podcast is about going in and peeling back the layers and exploring some of the less known parts of your becoming story as a way to better understand what makes you unique. It's a way of connecting the dots from your past to your present and your present going forward. So thank you so much for joining me in this adventure. And before we start, I'm wondering if there's any part of your journey, your becoming journey, that you're particularly curious about exploring today during this conversation.
I'd love to explore, you know, the idea of pivoting, the idea of, you know, belonging, perfection. I think that will all come out probably in who I am and how I just keep moving forward, even though I have to pivot and, you know, face some setbacks and confidence and keep going.
Okay. I'm very curious. I can't wait. So for our listeners who are discovering you for the first time, can you give us a little bit of a primer on who you are and how you came to become Madame de la Maison? Maybe you could tell us about what briefly that journey was like and what the mission behind the brand is.
Yeah, so Ajri, hello, hello. I'm Nigerian Jamaican. I was born in Nigeria. We moved to Austin, you know, just to tell you really quickly my, you know, story. Moved to Austin when I was about 5 years old, and grew up there in the suburbs of Austin. Moved to Fort Worth, couldn't wait to get out of Fort Worth after college, and moved to New York City to work in the fashion industry, which was very exciting. I always wanted to work in fashion and magazines. I got there and I was, you know, I loved it for a time. And then I realized it's not where I wanted to be anymore. So I made a pivot, changed directions, and started working, like moving towards the museum world. And I was interning and volunteering at the Costume Institute, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, working at the Museum of the City of New York, and going to grad school because I thought, you know, I wanted to like get more into like decorative arts and costume history. Which brought me to Paris while I was working on my master's thesis about Jean Patou. But then I really didn't see a path to getting a job at a museum, even though I'd already worked in museums. I started to kind of see like, maybe that's not exactly what I wanted to do. So I made a change and decided to go back to fashion, but like in a video way. So I was doing like video production. I was working for a guy. He was not a very wonderful person, but because of him, I met my husband, Thomas, and ended up moving back to Paris. And I was, you know, still doing video production, but then it kind of petered out for me. I no longer felt like passionate about that digital space, and, you know, started writing more, working on some projects. And then, you know, with a friend kind of talking about like where I saw myself, I thought, oh, should I start a supper club? And no, and she's like, no, maybe you should, you know, maybe do your own brand, your lifestyle brand. We started talking about that. And I was like, well, I do love inviting people over and I love going to the flea markets here. So I was actually in Vietnam, where Thomas was filming for a while. And I just started putting it all together, a business plan, bought a website, started putting Madame de la Maison together. And, you know, it's been 5 years now. And I think it's, you know, kind of perfect because, you know, I think every time you do a pivot, you're kind of like, oh, I failed at that. That didn't work out. You feel kind of bummed. But now I look at Madame de la Maison, which is all the parts of the different things that I was doing as a stylist, as wanting to work in costume history, learning about, you know, producing content with working in the digital video space. And so, you know, I take all of that and, you know, the mission behind Madame de la Maison is, you know, I'm inspired by bygone eras, as someone who loves history. But, you know, I kind of want to like encourage people to gather more in person. And I love the bygone eras where people did gather in person with a million different objects for the table, a million different reasons to gather. So Madame de la Maison's mission is really to sort of encourage people to gather, to keep gathering, but like to do it beautiful, you know, like with beautiful objects, which I find at the flea markets or, you know, I've started designing. So, you know.
So it's helping people find ways to gather in a way that's meaningful and beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, getting back to in-person gathering, but like honoring those moments by, you know, linen, styling table, you know, using things that you like to honor these moments. And it encourages you more to make memories and moments with people that you care about.
So I'm curious. Well, first, you said earlier that you were very excited to get out of Fort Worth. What was going on? What were you excited to leave behind when you were headed to New York?
You know, when I lived in Fort Worth, it was a time, you know, I think I've told you this before. I've always been this person where I always thought that things will be better when, like, I have to move on to something. Like, from the time I was in high school, I was thinking things are going to be better for me when I move out of this house. It's going to be better for me when I get out of Fort Worth, where I felt that, I felt like Fort Worth was a place where I was just always trying to fit into what, you know, was mostly white people at my university or at school. And I just felt like, well, in New York, it's going to be more diverse and there's going to be all kinds of different people. And I thought that I would fit more in that place. So I couldn't wait to get out of Fort Worth for that reason. I felt like New York promised me a place and a space where I wasn't trying to fit into a mold that, you know, I wasn't me, that didn't work for me, that, you know, I was never measuring up to.
So there was this kind of knowing inside of you that there was another place where you would feel more at ease and more yourself that you weren't experiencing where you were living.
Yeah. And also I will tell you in Fort Worth, you know, at TCU, at university, I was, you know, it's a very Greek school in the sense there's a lot of sororities and fraternities. And so when I got there, I wanted to join a sorority, like most people do there. And I thought, well, yeah, you know, everyone's going to want me. I was class president. You know, I was top of my class. You know, I was an athlete. I was, you know, head of all kinds of organizations. I had all the clothes. I remember at this time, I think I wanted to be a model, you know, like Naomi Campbell or something. So I thought, you know, I thought that I was pretty enough and had all the right looks. And then I tried to join a sorority, and out of 10 sororities, zero accepted me. Like zero offered me a place to join their sorority. And that was such a big, very, very hurtful, but I don't know, learning moment for me, because I was just kind of, yeah, I think it, I mean, it definitely marked my 4 years, you know, then, and, you know, it took a lot of bounce back to just be like, okay, well, I don't need to join a sorority. This doesn't have to be my college experience, but it hurt pretty bad. And it definitely made me question myself. And it was, you know, it was like first time away from home. But it definitely marked me wanting to get out of Fort Worth, even though I had a, you know, I ended up having a great college experience with great made lifelong friends. You know, I was just, that was how I started my freshman year. Like 3 weeks before classes started.
That sounds horrible.
And it was sort of like, and yeah, it was horrible. I mean, like in those sororities were predominantly white. And then the predominantly black sororities were kind of, you know, they kind of looked at me like, what is this girl doing? Why is she going to the wrong place? And so I started off my university feeling like I didn't belong with the black girls or the white girls. So, you know, that started my repetitive habit of saying, well, things are going to be better when I get to that next station, which is the heck out of here.
Well, I mean, it sounds like there's this, the repetitive pattern has perks, right? Because then you can see that you can use your discomfort and not feeling like you're connected and belonging to groups that are not including you as a way of keep searching for the place where you will feel a sense of belonging.
Yeah. And I think, you know, for so many years, I saw this experience as just like, you know, my first big, you know, my being met with, you know, not, you know, yeah, not, you know, not belonging. But I mean, I remember in middle school, or no, it was elementary school, there was these girls that had the I Hate Azrae and Pamela club, and they would run away from us, and we were the only two black girls in the class. So they did that for like a week until the teacher figured out what they were up to. But I think, yeah, definitely looking back on it, it's, you know, I could have either just been really sad and just kind of stayed in a place and said, well, these people don't want me, and went really to a side where I just allowed that to be the truth. But I think that there's something about who I am that, yes, I get put down, but I was like, I know this is not the truth, and maybe that's just not where I belong. And, you know, a lot of my college friends that I'm still friends with today were sorority girls. So it's just, you know, it doesn't mean they didn't like me, but that you know, the setup of that organization, the way it was run was, yeah, not the place that I needed to be. And yeah, I would keep kind of searching for, you know, what that place is that I am accepted and welcomed. And that's the place that in the end, I thrive.
So this is super cool. It's like, I mean, this thread that is being in a way, a guiding light for you, looking for the place where you're going to feel more yourself and connected, and a place where you could thrive brings you to New York. So going back to the mission of the brand, and connection. So in May of 2020, so just a few months into the pandemic, when we were all disconnected in lockdown, you wrote this very compelling blog post for your brand called A Case for the Good China. And in many ways, that manifesto was the seed that blossomed into your most current creation, your new book, Joie, A Parisian's Guide to the Good Life. Can you go back a little bit and tell us what that story and that specific moment meant for you when you wrote A Case for the Good China?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was sitting in that house. We left Paris. We left Paris, like, you know, the night Macron announced that, you know, everyone had till noon the very next day to, you know, not leave their homes. And we decided to leave that night to go to Pays Basque. And I remember kind of being like, oh, my stuff, I can't take my stuff with me. And then the next day it was just kind of like, not only do I not have my stuff, I don't have my people. Like, I felt kind of, I don't like, oh, just, you know, I didn't have the things that brought me joy, but I didn't connect mm-hmm. that at that moment. And, you know, but it was a time to sort of be really introspective. And I started kind of thinking about, you know, going into my thoughts and started, you know, decided to write this post and tell this story. Because I no longer could even use my China because it was back in Paris. I started thinking about this story about my mom, in which, you know, I'll let you guys discover the story, but it is a story about, you know, my mom having this wedding China that she loved and cherished and never wanted to use. And she died before she ever even got to eat a piece of toast off that China, you know, this wedding China. And she died before I got to sit with her and have share those plates. She would just, you know, keep it in her cabinet and not let anyone touch it. So for me, I kind of, as I wrote the article and, you know, it kind of went viral and I got so many messages about it. I started to kind of think like, so what is this? Like, what, you know, what is this moment that I'm living? What is this story about? And the story is really about, like, not only should you use your good China, but you should, you know, you should cherish moments and like live in the, you know, live with the things that bring you joy and to, you know, and I think that the response was very, really sparked a fire in me to kind of say like, okay, well, what are the things that bring us joy? And not only that, you know, like I've changed, I've become someone different in the time that I've lived in Paris. And I wanted to like investigate and explore what that was, which led to me starting to write a book proposal and kind of fleshing out, you know, using the good China is also, you know, finding joie de vivre and like taking and using those moments, living those moments.
Yeah. It's like noticing those moments. It's being able to acknowledge that those moments are around us and fostering in environments and experiences and connections that are going to help us be able to tap into the, like being presently aware that those moments are available to us. What do you think at the time resonated so much with people? And what did it reveal to you about like how your story could maybe help others or heal others in some way?
Yeah, I think it resonated so much because of the time and the place that we were all in. We were all having this like collective experience with COVID, with the pandemic, all over the world. We were all sort of like faced with, you know, mortality and the unknown and, you know, as I said earlier, like a separation from like people and things that, you know, we loved or, you know, we just kind of took them for granted or didn't think about them, but suddenly like we didn't know when the end of this whole pandemic was. And I think that when we were all kind of having that experience, then you read this article where someone's like telling you, you know, make sure that you use the good China and use the things that you love every day. I think it just really struck with people, I think, because of the collective experience, the time and the place. You know, had I written that article maybe before, I don't really know. Maybe people would have liked it, but it wouldn't have had, people would have connected with it, but maybe in a less intense way, perhaps, because it doesn't still change the fact that a lot of people got back with me and said, like, oh my God, you're so right. You know, I have my mom's silver that she passed down to me, and I don't know why I never use it. Or they would tell me their own stories of their parents who also had things that they loved. It's clearly a story that many people have experienced. You know, my mom, there are many other moms, many other grandmothers, people that just didn't use their goods, their things that they loved, you know, that were somehow precious, and they just didn't bring them out. But I think, you know, like I said, it's also a story that symbolizes something else, you know, so that I think that, like, as you're reading it and you're like, no, I never use my kachana. You know what? I have this dress that I bought and I never wear it. You know, I'm like, I have this trip I've been planning, but I like never do it. I think that it kind of like touched something that's already going on inside of people. You know, and then for me also, I was quite shocked. But also it got wheels running in my brain that so many people felt touched by this and reached out to me. And I started thinking about, you know, there I was sharing this story. I remember writing it, my brother helping me, like, you know, reading it before I put it out, and not realizing that, you know, the things that I've experienced in my life can maybe help another person. And that felt good to help another person. And it definitely, you know, also at this moment, you know, in COVID, I then decided to, you know, share more stories, you know, and realizing that my, you know, mistakes, my, the hard things that I've experienced in my life, like, don't really have to be embarrassed about them, but more, I think you, like, with that vulnerability, just realizing that, you know, it's just like, what's to be so embarrassed about, I guess, is now the place that I've come to with that, and just to share.
What would have been embarrassing?
I mean, not particularly anything about this story would be embarrassing. Maybe other than the fact that, I mean, okay, when I remember writing in the first part of that article where I say, like, you know, that we grew up eating in front of the TV a lot, eating on, you know, orange Tupperware, and eating, you know, Nigerians would, you know, sometimes paper plates, plastic plates. And here I was trying to be like Madame de la Maison, you know, creating this, like, selling 19th, 18th century things from French flea markets. But yet I grew up eating on Tupperware and paper plates in front of the TV. And was, you know, and the fine china was behind the cabinet. So, I mean, maybe that was kind of like an embarrassing thing to share, probably.
Sort of.
And to, like,
yeah, know, like, here you are promoting a style of life and a certain, maybe status and privilege and aesthetic that you maybe internally didn't feel like you deserved to be promoting because it was not in alignment with the way that you lived day to day when you were growing up.
It's an aesthetic that, yeah, that I didn't grow up with, that I didn't grow up with, you know, a certain kind of, like, you know, what one considers, like, taste and fine things. And so, yeah, I think that, you know, with all the etiquette rules and, oh, we sat down, we did this, and we went to, I didn't grow up with all that. So, yeah, in writing that article, I'm sort of like revealing that, yeah, I have this Madame de la Maison company, but, you know, I grew up eating on Tupperware.
I love it. Well, it's so great that you did, right? Because I think that it healed something in yourself, being able to unload that, not have to carry that discomfort of, like, the truth is not what you imagine the story should be about. And then also helping other people access that. Maybe, well, they have some kind of feeling of not being worthy of those good moments. There's something that you said there that it just keeps what I keep coming back to in my mind is this, the notion of we don't deserve to experience something joyful or pleasant because it's either not something that we've worked hard enough to achieve. The milestone is further down the line. We need to get to the graduation. We need to get to the wedding. We need to get to some kind of celebratory milestone in our life in order to deserve to appreciate what's good in our life, what's beautiful, what's precious. And I hear that a lot with my coaching clients, this idea like, oh no, mais je ne mérite pas. Like, I'm not deserving of it. I'm not legitimate enough. I haven't gotten there yet. It's further. I have to keep, like, I need to keep my eye on the prize.
Yeah.
How does that resonate? Because there's a big message in your book that's about not waiting. There's almost an urgency about not waiting for this moment when suddenly everything aligns and you feel like, ça y est, I can check the mark and I'm living the life that is deserving enough for me to be able to partake in something that is maybe a little bit more symbolically luxurious or aesthetically highbrow, that it's something that we can experience as long as we allow ourselves to.
I don't know if like urgency is the word that I think to myself, but maybe it is definitely a call to kind of not wait, you know, because I did so much waiting and I think we all do so much waiting. I mean, like, first of all, I don't know where this came from, this idea that there has to be like a certain amount of money for the good life. There has to be a certain privilege. I mean, I do know where it comes from. It's all the things that we consume and, you know, everything that we watch. And there's this idea that, yeah, we don't deserve certain things. But I think if we just start telling ourselves that that's just not true, it's just not. Even if it's like trying to like unprogram our mind that we're not worthy of the good life, or that the good life, you know, means you have to have like private XYZ and all kinds of everything. You start to maybe realize and maybe even ask yourself like, great, those things are wonderful. You know, it's really fun. But if you don't have those things, you can do your good life a different way. You know, your good life can look a little different from that other person's good life. What is that quote about like, you know, comparison is like the thief of joy. You know, if you like focus on like what your good life is, you know, my good life does not include yachts and private jets. I decided, you know, a good life for me is something else. It's like being able to travel, being able to get together with drinks, you know, and food with friends. It's, you know, it's finding moments where I can sneak away and like be by myself. It's wandering around and looking at beautiful buildings. Like for me, that's the good life for me. So it's, you know, it's like kind of deciding like what the good life is for you and then doing it in the present. So like, you know, there's no reason I don't deserve that. You know, there's no reason. I think we have to, I was talking with someone recently and I think maybe we just were programmed by different cultures. I mean, at this point, I thought it was like American and Nigerian culture because that's the ones I know. But, you know, if you say you experience this with French people too, I think we all have to just keep reminding ourselves that like there's no day but today.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very liberating mindset shift when we can feel like we're in control of whether or not we are able to identify and embody those good life moments without having to wait for someone else to give us the validation to go ahead and go for it. I mean, it's almost like it's part of the culture to constantly be pursuing some next goal on the, you know, on the, that benchmark as a way of keeping us motivated.
And then you have to make a conscious, you have to make a conscious decision to reject that. And, you know, for me as a young person, I was kind of, you know, like I said, I just was always thinking things would be better when, and I definitely wasted a lot of moments that I could have been more present and enjoyed where I was, you know, and you know, even when I moved to Paris, you know, like I didn't really understand Joie de Vivre. And at the time I was just kind of like, oh, I need a group of friends. And, oh, I'm watching my friends on social media and they're like doing all these gatherings and I don't know anyone here. And what a shame, because I didn't have kids and I could have like freely roamed the city and gone to all the museums and read a bazillion books that I want to read. And now I'm, the past is the past, but if I wasn't too busy, you know, thinking that my life wasn't good enough, I could have actually done a lot of great things, accomplished a lot of stuff.
Yeah, it's a good old FOMO. Just waddling in the feeling of comparison and not being included, and that, it, you know, just masks all of the opportunities that you have to enjoy where you are.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a practice. Do you have a practice? Do you have like an active practice of identifying your, you know, the those moments of good life that you actively seek out?
I mean, not a formal practice other than journaling and, you know, finding a notebook and, you know, forcing myself to write down, you know, either gratitude or, you know, there was this book I read, somebody recommended to me, I think it's The Gap and the Gain, and just sort of like realizing all the great things that are in my life and writing that down so that when I'm kind of like, you know, I kind of get in this, like, I'm missing out or I'm missing something or like there's a gap. I kind of, you know, snap myself back into action, grab that notebook that's on the side of my bed and just like reread, you know, how wonderful I am in this place and how wonderful my life is and the people around me are in this place and how far I've come. So, you know, that's more practice, just writing it. And then whenever I need that little reminder, just grab that book on the side of my bed and go sit at the cafe and read it.
And what is the distinction then between, you know, the pursuit of happiness and the pursuit of joy? How many of you felt joy without necessarily being happy, or happy without feeling joy? How do you distinguish those two?
Well, when I was writing the book, you know, I think that I probably, you know, I don't think I understood in the beginning the difference between joy and happiness, you know, because they are often confused. And then you gave me this lovely book from Brené Brown, Atlas of the Heart. And I started to kind of like understand that those words could mean two different things. You know, happiness is sort of like, is, you know, based on your immediate environment, your circumstances. Sometimes it's science. Joy is something that is a little deeper. It's less vulnerable to moments of life. It's about connections. It's about pleasure. It's about awe. It's something that, you know, you can actually tap into joy in the midst of happiness or unhappiness. And when my neighbor said like, oh, well, how can you write about the French being all joy, joy, joy when they like complain all the time and have strikes? And I was like, well, have you seen what the strikes look like here? You know, there's the guy pushing his kebab cart and selling wine and beer while they're like marching in the streets. They're having a pretty good time, you know, like, it's, you know, they might complain, but, you know, they still know how to tap into joy. You know, they can be complaining while they're all at the cafe in the afternoon. So, you know, like I myself have definitely had many unhappy moments here or many rough patches. You know, starting a business is a rough patch for me. I usually tend to like get really stressed out or maybe kind of like dip into depression and moments of change, you know, becoming a new mom, starting a business, becoming a second time mom. Those are always moments for me, but then I've realized how to tap into joy is kind of like, okay, I'm going to go meet a friend for a cafe. I'm going to like gather a bunch of people at my house. You know, I'm going to go and, you know, just, I've learned ways to tap into joy in the midst of unhappiness, which I did not know before. You know, I just would just stay in a gloomy moment and just stay there.
Mm. So you said like tapping into joy. So it's an action. It's a way, it's a tool that you could use to get yourself out of a funk, out of a, like a gloomy day.
I don't know if it's going to get you out of your gloomy day, because that's what I'm trying to say, that like, you know, happiness can sometimes be a science, right? Like you mm-hmm. are depressed. You just lost someone in your life. You just lost your job. But in the midst of that unhappiness, I mean, if you can't just also people like all these books about like the pursuit of happiness, I think like the Yale study is like a lot of the things that we think are going to give us happiness, mm-hmm. money, all that kind of stuff, they mm-hmm. actually don't. Like scientifically. So when you think about joy, it's kind of, even if you just lost your job, you know, walking.
Wait, hold on 1 second. I got something on my end. Hold on.
Okay.
Ugh, so annoying these. Hold on. Okay, sorry. We can go back.
You know, you can have, yes, you can have moments where you're unhappy, but you can, you know, seek something that's going to bring you joy. You know, you can be going through a rough time, yet, you know, take yourself to an exhibition or, you know, wander around a city. And, you know, that little feeling that you'll have in that moment, that's joy. You know, like people can't really. Yeah, I think it's just kind of understanding that, like, and also the fact that joy, you know, doesn't cost you anything, actually. So, sure, like a big joy would be, yes, traveling on a trip, that might cost you something. But like a small joy might be just saying, like, you know what, I have all these meetings all day long, and they're stressing me out. I'm going to just go mm-hmm. have lunch and sit with a magazine or a book. And, you know, if that's a joy for you to just like not be doing, you know, doing your work all day and you're, you know, doing something for yourself, like that's a joy, I think. And that doesn't cost mm-hmm. any money. You know, it's just about doing something that brings you, you know, pleasure.
Yeah. There's something really empowering about that idea that we all have that capacity to at least try to look for those moments of joy, whether or not we're going to succeed at shifting the entire mood. But that mm. it's like a way of kind of excavating through just a monotony or routine and being able to identify those moments where yeah. we connect with something else. And I was listening to recently a podcast with Ross Gay, who has written about joy. And he emphasized that the facet of joy being about connection. And you talk about that in your book as well, is that connection is kind of the undercurrent of the joy that you create when you're bringing people together, when you're connecting with objects that have a story to them, that have a legacy, that have this beauty. And so how is connection a way of embracing imperfection and not waiting for those moments where everything is aligned? It's almost like bypassing what we think perfection should look like and instead looking for a connection with something.
I think, you know, wanting to be perfect is about a lot of things. Like perfection is about a lot of things. Like what I said earlier, trying to like measure up and to fit in to someone else's idea or your own mm-hmm. idea, right? You know, perfection is not progress, as we know, but also perfection robs you of connections. Mm. You know, like, I think one, you can look at my sorority story in one way of like, I was trying to be perfect as opposed to like having like a college experience where I just like go to college and connect with people. I wanted to be perfect for this other, you know, this box that I could join. You could also look at it like, you know, for me, wanting to look a certain way, wanting to entertain, you know, in the case of Madame de la Maison, and me wanting to entertain a certain way. And, you know, I think that I wanted, you know, to be like the best entertainer and like make the best recipes, and they were, I mean, it was just usually a disaster, you know, where you'd come to my house and you wouldn't eat till like 10 p.m. everything wasn't ready and I was just like shuffling around. And then I kind of realized like what was more important to me was the people that I was with, was the actual, like, you know, the connections that I form out of this, out of having people over to my house. Like, nobody's going to remember what cookbook I chose from. I mean, I don't know. I've cooked so many kinds of, oh my God, I think I now remember one day you came over and I was trying to make some like ragu that took like a zillion hours and a zillion different things to make. And do you even remember that?
I think, was that the one when you were, it was like Adri V1, your first trip through Paris and we were at Stevens? I think that there was
probably, I mean, like,
I do remember you being very, very active in the kitchen and we were all out in the, sitting around and having conversations.
Yes.
Yeah.
Without me, you know? So I think that, you know, I think for me, you know, the idea of perfection not being my goal in life definitely comes from those cooking stories. It comes from, you know, definitely, you know, shaving my head. It comes from all these experiences where I sort of realized that while I was trying to be perfect, in the end, like, people still love me for who I am. They still, you know, I'm still like, what I got more were when I would have these connecting moments and not, you know, trying to be polished or, you know, fit into anyone's standard.
Well, it's like, again, that idea of shedding the quest for perfection and I guess for the seeking of that particular milestone that's going to allow you to deserve to partake in something that brings you joy is a way for you to then bubble up the intense need and I guess human quest that we have to feel connected and to feel like we belong and that we're embraced for who we are. And it's almost like this unraveling of those messages around you have to look a particular way, you have to entertain a particular way, you have to wait for that perfect moment to come in order to appreciate the life that you have. Once you could start shedding that, it's like the world suddenly really shifts. And it's very liberating and empowering, but it's kind of like a radical message.
Yeah. And I just made the connection right now when you said that I probably never thought about was, you know, not waiting for the good China is also connected to like not being perfect, right? Not waiting for a perfect moment for anything. So I never put those two together, but you're right. It is a radical message because it goes against, I think, what the large majority of society messages kind of tell us and most people around us maybe are doing. But I think probably that's what is resonating so well with what I'm doing, or, you know, the way that I share me is that I'm not perfect. I'm not trying to do things perfect. And I think that's why people like what I'm doing or, you know, like my messaging is because it maybe in a little way, it frees them to realize, oh, okay, we don't have to iron our linens and like, you know, iron everything and make it perfect before everyone comes over. Oh, okay. We can like use mix and match plates and mix and match glassware. Okay. You know, oh, we don't, you know, we can just do a like apéro with some charcuterie and some peanuts and invite a friend over.
As long as you know how to cut the cheese, as long as you know how to cut.
And you know what? And I, even though I put that cheese etiquette in the book, I specifically said in the text, it's just for fun. Nobody cares how you cut that cheese.
But it is funny that you're talking about cutting the cheese. I want to talk a little bit about total work of art. So when we're talking about you and what you are allowing other people to experience, in a way, I feel like you are providing us with a glimpse of what your quote total work of art is. And I'm going to introduce that concept through the story that you share in your book about what you were studying when you were studying interiors and fashion. And how, you'll explain this a lot better. You were doing your master's in decorative arts and you were studying how objects and fashion help you understand and appreciate what is called a total work of art, which is the expression of a particular culture at the time. Can you tell us a little bit about that concept? And I thought that was really fascinating. And from there, I kind of want to piggyback on that and talk about, like, what do you think your total work of art is right now?
So in school, we, you know, in studying the deck of arts, we kind of did this other way around of looking at things. You know, it's called the methodology we use is called mm-hmm. material culture. So you look at a culture and then you back up and you think about what is happening in the culture, what is happening in society, economics, everything. And then what is the material that comes out of that, right? So that was the methodology that I used to go into, a lot of the studies. But then I discovered this word called Gesamtkunstwerk. And I think, which means total work of art. And I decided to apply that to my research to look at how you can look at a person, interiors, a designer, someone, and kind of ask what their total work of art is, their life philosophies, their what they wear, how they live their life. And I was really sort of fascinated about, the circles, people that they come together with. And, material culture, just to kind of give an extra explanation on that is kind of saying in the 1920s and 23, they discovered King Tut's tomb, and all of a sudden, you see a proliferation of Egyptian ornamentation on clothes and, in interiors. So that's what I mean when I say material culture, working backwards to see how what's happening in the culture ends up in our material. So, yeah, that was a really fun study and way to look at someone. And of course, mine was Jean Patou. But, when I think about me and my total work of art, it's definitely, for sure, I think, it's about connections, bringing people together, but finding joy in that, but also in stories. I think objects have stories of a past and then being with them in the present. I think when I gather people at my table, we all have stories of our past, but we're, in the present with our, making new stories, weaving our old stories, sharing our stories. Now we say that gathering at the table is a place where souls, our souls and our stories collide at this table. And I think that that's representative, the way that I design my home, the way that I live my life, with the people that I'm around, definitely, the way that I dress. It's a little bit of the past bringing the present, but also the importance of stories and meaningful connections and joy and things that bring us joy, for sure.
It's such a, as you're saying this, I'm like, my brain is lighting up, thinking about all the things that you bring to the, that you bring as an expression of something that is much larger than just you. It's like you are the sum of more of your individual parts. The jewelry that you bring that you can tell stories about, where you found it at the market, the caftans that to me represent this like ease and embracing of, and also ability to kind of go with whatever the evening sets your way. So you're not worrying about are my pants too tight? Am I going to be restricted in what I'm wearing?
Yeah. Yes, my body is not perfect, so I can flow around.
Exactly. I mean, it's like this, but I think I hadn't seen it this way. Because for me, I was questioning what is your just cause? What is the way that you see the world? How is it that you see the world that no one else sees the world? Is that your total work of art? And now you're saying that in a way, the way that you show up and the way you bring people together is connecting back to the stories that each person has inside of them that they can then reveal by being in a collaborative space.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and that's what I love about gathering. That's what I love about people. That's what I love about buying antiques and finding ways to mix them in, in our modern life. It's, bringing together elements and people. And I think, yeah, when you think about total work of art and how, like, what is my, you know, how does it all fit together? I think it all fits seamlessly. You know, it's not like, when you think of total work of art in that way, it's as if you, like, imagine if I was someone who loves antiques and loves bringing people together, but then was a minimalist. Those don't work together. You see what I'm saying? It's like, there's nothing minimal about me.
Yeah, you know? But I don't know. I feel like that could be done in a minimalist style. Like, it depends on what, how you interpret minimalist.
Yeah, yes. You could be, yes. But in trying to be true to what my total mm-hmm. work of art is, I don't need anything minimal about it. I need to have a lot of color and a lot of layers and mm-hmm. a lot of texture with people, with stories, with life. Like, I need it to be kind of messy and imperfect, and that's my way of doing it.
Yeah, so to create the space for spontaneity, that it's like not the it's kind of not controlled in a way. It's not constricted.
Yeah.
You have this like this breezy openness yeah. and opulence. It's cool because I'm it's almost like, do you think that had you not been in France, that you would have been able to express this part of yourself so completely and so freely? Like, how has France helped you find this in yourself?
Yeah, I mean, this is a funny question that came up last week with a group of people. And I think definitely France has allowed me to, yes, to express myself in this way and to be open in this way. And just because, you know, by basic facts, that France kind of is a place that I found that I could comfortably live, you know, without having like loads mm-hmm. of money. It's kind of a place where you can live comfortably. I can live comfortably. It's been a place where, because like, for example, and I just can only give examples from my own personal past life, which would be like in New York, I kind of felt like in the circles that I was in, there was a lot of like, I felt like I needed to like show out and, you know, have the right things and have this or have that. And kind of Paris is a place, like if you show off, people will just roll their eyes at you. they will give you a look that in my experience has been incredibly uncomfortable. Yeah, people don't really respond well to that and they're not impressed. So that allowed me to realize, okay, I don't really need to do that. It's also like, you know, physically and beauty wise, I talk about this in the book also, you know, in where I was back home, I felt like I needed to look a certain way. And I felt like there was a lot of artifice and, you know, all the weaves and the wigs and the hair. And not to say that people don't have that here. It just felt like a place where, you know, I made the decision to shave my head and I, you know, walked around like nobody really cared that I'd shaved my head. And I remember somewhere in my mind, I thought that if I shaved my head in America, it meant like a political statement. Like I was like part, it was like, you know, it's very like a black woman with a shaved head was such political statement at a time in the 90s. And, you know, those codes aren't here. So, and also people just generally didn't care. And then I got to sort of be free, you know, in myself, not feeling that I had to put on makeup anymore or that, you know, like every day. So it's definitely, you know, beauty wise, it's living in France has allowed me that freedom, you know, that like the freedom of like not kind of putting so much stock in how mm-hmm. I look. And then when I let that go, then I've just, you know, I keep living my life and I keep having all the same friends. And then it sort of gives me this power in a sense, because I'm just kind of like, okay, I can keep doing what I'm doing without, it's like letting go of like, okay, do I look okay? Does my hair look okay? Do I have, you know, all the right stuff? Do I have all the right designer things? So I don't think I could have done that back home. I mean, now I go back home and, you know, I have a friend who always makes fun of me because he's like, oh, Ashrie doesn't care. She doesn't care. You know, I'm like, it's not that I don't care. It's just that there's certain things that just aren't important to me anymore. So you know, after living here for 12 years, and then I can go home and see, you know, my friend will be like, "Ugh, you're lucky because here I need to have like a different outfit every other day." And I'm like, we don't even have closet space for all that. So,
The truth is that people just don't have the space for it. Well, I love this idea of you not knowing it really when you arrive here, that this the baggage of trying to be perfect and fit in and meet a certain ideal of, you know, beauty and perfection was not, it's like, you know, round hole, square peg. It's not fitting. So why you don't have to do it. You don't have to keep that up. It's like energy that you don't have to spend anymore on trying to impress anyone because no one's impressed by that. And so you just like, you're like,
Exactly.
okay, well, all right. Okay, so then you find other things that you want to do with your body, with your time, with your energy, with your money, and kind of reconstruct
Absolutely.
your own, set of values and your guiding principles, your North Star. And like recalibrate that. And that's so cool to be able to do that. And then share your learnings from that point of view. I'm curious, when you were back in America for your book tour, you spoke to a lot of people. You were there for a month. And so your readers there and the people you're interacting with are mostly Americans, I assume. What parts of your story and the messaging, kind of like you've gone out and experienced the world and you have these learnings and these revelations to kind of share with them, which of those messages did you feel resonated the most? And how has the questions you've been asked in response helped you better understand the role that you are playing in other people's becoming stories?
I think, you know, we've said it a few times, but definitely, you know, the Good China story, people really love, you know, connect with that. You know, and the fact that they can experience joy and it doesn't need like money or power or place, you know, that people commented on that a lot. Like it was, I think it was like an aha moment for some people, like, oh yeah, I can do this. You know, like the chapter where I talk about like just learning to be, like, you know, sometimes just wandering around your city. I like that there were so many messages in the book that really touched people. And, you know, just the idea that joy can just also be something very simple and very small, you know, like going to the farmer's market. And I really liked hearing people on the road kind of tell me that that meant a lot to them, that they're going to try to do that in their life, you know, that it encouraged them. People asked me, wanted to know, you know, how can they share joy with their kids? How can they show and teach their kids, model joy for their kids? I liked all the questions that people were asking me along the road and sharing with me. It definitely made me think about, yeah, the role that I play in other people's lives, and that I should, you know, keep showing up and doing more of that, even though sometimes it feels very uncomfortable and very vulnerable to share. As you know, when I was writing this, I was like, oh, people are gonna tell me that I, you know, I don't know, and they're gonna say this and they're gonna say that. But, you know, in the end, the people who do say the negative stuff have been like not even 1% co in comparison to the other side, which is people saying, well, thank you for sharing that. Thank you for reminding me. You know, thank you for encouraging me. And definitely, yeah, as I say, it's been a lesson of vulnerability. And, you know, just me, you know, in the beginning, when I started Madame de la Maison, I didn't want anyone to know that it was by me. I wanted to just create a brand that somebody would like, and they wouldn't be able to reject it when they, you know, because maybe I just assume maybe they'd be racist, or they'd be saying like, you know, who is this, you know, Tupperware toting Nigerian telling us this stuff? And But, you know, going on tour and traveling around the world, you know, people came. They came to tell me that they liked what I was doing. I share myself in Instagram, and people don't care. You know, Black women are thankful. Thank you for sharing. Thank you for, you know, showing up. White women say thank you. Oh my God, I love what you're doing. Latin women, it's just been, you know, from every side. So I think that's been a really wonderful eye-opening, encouraging experience and lesson for myself.
That's so like soothing to the, you know, it's just like soothing on such an amazingly deep level that you've been able to come through your own doubts about yourself and your vulnerability and your background and really embody your place as a representation of a Black woman who has the key to the good life and the knowledge on how to enjoy and rest and find pleasure. And I know this is something that's really important to you. We've talked about this, the idea of, you know, the importance of representation and how is that now sitting for you that you are contributing to a shift in the narrative around what a Black woman represents today?
I think representation matters in every aspect of life, you know, and business. I think, you know, Black women, unfortunately, are, I think, not often shown in this light of, like, you know, living a good life, living a joyful life. You know, there's all these stereotypes of, like, the angry Black woman. Or, you know, when there's books and there's, you know, things that are praised about women, Black women are often, you know, about hair or about the struggle. So, you know, for me to arrive in this space and, you know, what you said earlier about to be a Black woman and to be celebrated for telling this story, like, that's a big thing to me. It's a big thing to me. And it's I see a big thing to a lot of other people, you know, the DMs and the emails that I get where people are, I mean, people are just like, thank you for just doing this and just like living your, like, they're impressed, you know, that I'm just living a life and yes, skipping around the streets of Paris and going to the market. And we need to have more of that. We need to show more Black women in that way so that maybe, you know, one day in my daughter's, you know, in further generations, we can weaken the other stereotype and maybe strengthen this one a little bit. Mm. If anything, it's a message to encourage other Black women that yes, you can be angry. You can be upset about, you know, the fight, but you can also live a really good life and enjoy life and be happy. And that's okay. That's, you know, I've said that's also part of contributing to ending racism, to changing, you know, if people, that's what will change racism, not just, you know, a Black square or, you know, when everyone was doing a Black square. It's more than that. It's about connection. It's about meeting people. It's about ideals and how you see them. And that, you know, that's what we need to do.
That's so optimistic and empowering. And it makes me think about the story that you share in your book about your grandmother who, really had a knee-jerk reaction to anyone just resting in the house, that it was like a taboo. Yeah. And what was the expression? Idle hands are the devil's work.
It was yes, exactly.
And yeah. I want to kind of end on this because this was also one of the very provocative quotes that I heard from Ross Gay about how the act of seeking of joy and the pursuit of connection is also a way to kind of heal our family lineage, kind of shifting the narrative and feeling like you have the control in your life to partake in moments of joy and you, that you have that kind of autonomy. It can also maybe heal past generations who felt threatened by that idea. for whom it was really not an option. And so with that in mind, what would you say to the women in your family? Or what would you like to share with them in the representation that you are providing us all with? What do you think that they're taking away from it? And how is your connection to the women in your past?
Well, my grandmother, my mother, my two aunts, they're no longer here on this earth. They worked hard to, yes, with their idle hands, but grandma, idle hands are okay. It's okay for us to be idle. And I think they would be proud and they would be happy because they all taught me joy, in the way that they love to gather and to, do it in their own way. And I think that they would be proud. And I think that they would rest. I think, if my mom was here and she was coming to Paris, I get to show her, mom, you don't need to do all that kind of stuff. Let's just go sit at the cafe with Numi and hang out, and I think that they would appreciate it, after years of feeling like they couldn't sit down, that they had to always be doing something and helping someone and moving around and working. I think it would be nice for them to just know that I appreciate what they did. And now they get to rest because they're, they're in heaven. Oh, that was their message. You can say like, you can rest when you die when you're in heaven.
And you're like, let's just bump that up a little bit earlier than that.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much, Ajuri, for being your gorgeous, inspiring, vulnerable, and just very authentic self, and for imparting your joy and your messages and inspiring a whole new way of thinking about tapping into joy every day and not worrying about the scriptures about what perfection and what the pursuit of it should look like. So you're doing an amazing job.
Absolutely.
Thank you for being in our lives.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I am so appreciative of having your time and your attention and would love to hear anything you have to say, any feedback, any questions, any requests. You can leave me a voice message if you go to speakpipe.com/onbecoming. That's speakpipe, speakpipe.com/onbecoming. I promise to get back to you. If this podcast has touched you, inspired you, transformed you in any way, it would mean the world to me if you would leave a 5-star review on your favorite podcast listening platform.